the director was one of the writers, and one of the actors was one of the writers. I wonder if they slept together. Because that's important, right?
Probably. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are my co-host, Richard Wally.
And from Los Angeles, California, you're my co-host, Cassidy Robinson.
Today was the voting day. We did the voting here in California.
We did that long time ago.
Yeah, you guys were ahead of us by a few months over in Oregon.
We were, and it's funny to me because you had to like go into a building. Oregon's great. You get it. They send you a packet. They explain everything to you, all the candidates, and then you just you circle in the little bubbles and you send it back to them, or you can take it to a library.
Right. I would also imagine that Oregon's a fully open primary.
Could be. I don't know.
Ours was like a semi-closed or something like that. I don't 100% know what all of those terms mean, but
are you talking about like our closed primaries when it's closed unless you're like a specific member of the party?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a closed. It's also closed.
Oh, okay.
But it was pretty easy. You just got online and said, yes, I'm a Democrat. And then they sent you the packet.
I could have done the mail-in, but I registered to vote about 2 weeks ago. And I was nervous that if I did a mail-in, it wouldn't come in time. I'm sure it would have, but I just didn't want to risk it.
Sure.
And, yeah. And you know me, I like to do things in person. When I'm dealing with things that are electronic or, I mean, mail's a little better because at least that's like physical paper.
So control issues for the electronic system. It makes sense.
Yeah. So I like to go through every step of the process. So, luckily, where I was polled was only like a block away from my house.
Like, and then they threw it straight, your ballot straight into the dumpster.
Yeah, right in front of me. They're like, that's what we think of your rights. And then, not even a dumpster, just a shredder right there that went into a trash can the side of the table.
That happens.
Instead of the I voted sticker, they just gave me a Mr. Yuck. It was over at the Venice High School, which is just a walk away from me, which was good. And I was worried that it was going to be like a 3-hour line because there's all this stuff you hear about, like these crazy lines. It's like totally disorganized stuff and like people getting the wrong ballot. So I thought it was just going to be like anarchy. I was going to be walking into a riot zone. And I tried to be early because I had to go to work also.
Sure.
It's a busy day for me. I voted, went to work. Now I'm recording a podcast. But no, and ended up being like super dead. I pretty much walked in and it was kind of weird because they had like a map of all the districts and everything. And then they had different tables depending on which district you were in, even though I thought this one area code was a district. But I guess there's many districts within the district. And it worked out, but it was really convoluted like ballot form. Like it was like a Scantron from high school, you know, like the little fill out the bubbles.
Sure.
And the way they did it, it made sense once somebody showed me, but I had to have someone show me, is you like put it through this little booklet, and every time you turn a page, it flips to the next column that it aligns with, and then there's little arrows that point from the candidates to the coinciding bubble, and then they give you like this little black pushy pen stampy thing that you click into the bubble. So it was, I was a little afraid there was going to be like a hanging chad situation.
That's what it sounds like. I was like, is this, are there going to be hanging chads in the story? What's happening? We just had a multiple choice test. I filled in the little bubbles I wanted to fill in and then it was done.
Essentially, that's what it was too. I mean, not a test, but I mean, once, like I said, once it made sense. But at first it was just like, here's all of these strange objects you've never seen before. Put them in the right combination to vote.
So you felt like a monkey?
A little bit. I was like, I don't know what to do with these three objects you have in front of me. So yeah, that was my day.
Stack the shapes in the corresponding way. Mm. I went to the beach, so my day was better.
Oh, well, I mean, I guess that's as cool as performing a civic duty, but...
I already performed my civic duty, and then I went to the beach.
You rewarded yourself with the beach. Yeah, which beach? Was it the same one I went to?
Which one?
You took me to the one over by Tillamook.
I just remembered...
Goonies Rocks.
Oh yeah, Cannon Beach. We went there for a little bit. Then we went down to one called Manzanita, and then we also went to Rockaway Beach. We went to a few different beaches, just kind of checking them out, see what they were like.
Did you say Rockaway Beach?
Yeah, I did.
Like the Ramones song?
Yeah.
But that doesn't make any sense. I thought Rockaway Beach was in
I'm sure there's
New
Rockaway
York
beaches.
Or Jersey.
I think there's Rockaway Beaches in Oregon, Washington, California, and all down the East Coast, probably.
Hmm. It's one of those things, like how there's a Paris, Texas.
Right.
Yeah.
Or there's a Portland, Maine.
Yeah. Very confusing. Geography.
It's one of those vexing things of life, the geography. Yes. This is a movie review podcast.
It is.
You usually have to remind people of that. By this time, we're talking about clones and...
I was about to come up with a very bizarre theory about how the East Coast is actually just a mirror clone version of the West Coast, so you're not far off.
Oh, once you pass the Mississippi, you're going into mirror land?
Yeah.
I've thought about that myself.
Like in Superman 2, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Today we're going to be reviewing Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping is our main review, and then we're finally going to cover Prince Avalanche, which we put off last week. Mostly my fault. We did have one suggestion for a punishment.
Oh, we did?
It was from Winston Conrad.
Oh, good.
And I'll read it once we review Prince Avalanche, because I don't have it in front of me at the very moment.
Well, unless it's getting wet and eating, I'm not going to be pleased. Like, you have to be doing both at the same time.
At the same time, yeah.
Like, you have to be eating, like, a hot dog while in the shower.
You want to hear one of the grossest stories?
Where is this going? Yes,
about
I do.
About me as a kid? I think maybe okay. I've told you. I don't know. I don't even know if this will make it on the podcast, but I feel like telling you this right now. When I was a kid... I really like dunking cookies in the milk because I was a kid. And
sure.
Fuck it. Dunking cookies in the milk is still awesome.
That's not.
Yeah, weird. That's not, okay. Not cool. Like that's a timeless event. Yeah. But when I was a kid, I didn't understand necessarily like that it was the milk that makes cookies taste good. I just thought it was the wetness that I liked from that. And now we were out of milk one time and we ate those like really cheap, like gigantic sandwich cookie packs that you can buy for like 99 cents back in the early 90s. It was like for poor people.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about.
Obviously.
They're kind of like Oreos, but they're disgusting. So.
And they come in like lemon. And
yeah. And horrible flavors that shouldn't even be cookies. But we had like the chocolate ones and we were out of milk. I just took the cookies into the bathroom and like ran them under the sink and was
Those cookies aren't good anyways. What are you doing? What were you thinking? People have weird childhood thoughts, but...
I mean, I was really young. This isn't like 8. I was like 5 or something.
12 or... I'm still, I don't know.
You're judging me?
I never
me?
Had that. I'm judging
it's super
you, yes.
Gross. Like now
even
when
as an 8-year-old or a 5-year-old, I would have been like, what are you doing? That's gross, dude. Don't do that.
All right, let's go ahead and get into the movie news. I'll start with this one. I thought it was kind of cool sounding. Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis are possibly going to reunite for a period piece, another period piece about the 1950s fashion industry. Variety is reporting this. I guess Megan Ellison is set to produce the film through Annapurna Pictures, and the movie is definitely going to happen. We just don't know yet if Daniel Day-Lewis is set to star, but like we were saying at the beginning of the podcast, Paul Thomas Anderson, who they did There Will Be Blood together, he often reuses actors. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman was in like almost all of his movies up to a point. So yeah.
You mean the point he died?
Up until the point in which he died, yeah.
Okay.
And he wasn't in There Will Be Blood, and at that point he was still alive. So because of that, I would say that's a very likely possibility that Daniel Day-Lewis would work with him again, especially since he won an Oscar for being in There Will Be Blood, so.
Oh, no, it makes total sense. I mean, everything you said, him reusing actors, I mean, I doubt that there would be, like, a big beef between the two. I don't think that they're those kind of... But yeah, no. Sure. I mean, I kept talking about how I wanted there to be a milkshake scene in this, or it be just a direct sequel to There Will Be Blood, where
in real time,
yeah, 100-year-old oil baron gets into the fashion industry, and he starts just killing folk to make the best dress. It makes sense to me. I don't know. I mean, I've always said that There Will Be Blood is like one of the best adaptations of Dracula. And I know that sounds crazy, but that's all I see when I see him playing that character is I'm like, he's going to kill somebody.
The movie is very much directing you to feel that way.
Exactly.
And it's one of the best studies in building tension ever, like in letting it stretch to the point of no return.
And that's what I want them to do. Like, if they're going to do Universal Monsters and try to make them scary, I was like, just make P.T. Anderson do it. Just make him.
Yeah, he would do a really good version of it. I don't know if it'd be the version they want necessarily, especially if they want to build a cinematic universe out of monster movies. But back to this. One thing that I'm noticing with Paul Thomas Anderson, if you look at like his body of work.
Sure.
Not all of it, but a lot of it. He seems to be very interested in these zeitgeisty periods of time. These moments that defined a big change in America.
Sure.
So you look at The Master, which also takes place in the 50s, but is also very much about its time and place. Or you look at There Will Be Blood, which is the beginning of the oil industry as a whole starting. Or you look at Boogie Nights, which is like a certain period in the adult film industry that changed everything, and the 70s in general, and the death of the disco movement and all of that stuff. Like he seems to be like one by one, and even Inherent Vice, which kind of tackled the 70s in a different way, or the end of the 60s to the beginning of the 70s. It's like one
counter
by one.
Culture, yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. One by one, he's like documenting these different periods of time and these different perspectives on these breaking moments in American culture. So I think that could be really interesting to see what he does with this industry and that time period. We already know he can do the 50s really well.
That was a much more serious take on that, too, I will say.
On that news story?
Maybe it's just I can individually, but that was a very good like synopsis of his career and stuff like that. I'm kind of complimenting you just in a sort of strange way.
Well, thank you. I'll take it.
That was well done, Cassidy. There, I did it.
What's your first
complimented
story?
John Boyega. A lot of people know him from Star Wars or Attack the Block, maybe. He's going to take one of the lead parts in the Pacific Rim sequel,
Which is happening again, I guess.
I think it's been one of those. Yeah. It was going to happen. Guillermo del Toro is not the director of it. It's the.
Oh, that's right.
Stephen DeKnight, the guy that did like Daredevil and Spartacus. I think this is his first time kind of really stepping into a
blockbuster
picture.
Yeah.
Right. And Boyega is going to be playing Idris Elba's child in the film. So Backer Pentecost was Idris Elba's character in the first one. And he died, and so there's sort of like this lineage,
like Jaws the Revenge.
Oh, just like except, it jumps the shark.
Yeah, because remember that was the whole thing with like the Roy Scheider died, and so his wife like had to kill the shark or something.
Oh wow, yeah, that's the way to go. I don't know if I've seen the sequels. I know that's.
You've never seen the Jaws sequels?
I don't think so.
You really don't have to, but you should. I mean, I can't really advise it in any kind of positive way, but right. If Jaws was the beginning of the blockbuster, then like the Jaws sequels is like the beginning of like horrible blockbuster sequels.
And, fair enough.
Yeah. The diminishing returns just like are exponential from movie to movie until Jaws 4 is like barely a movie. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, Del Toro, this is what he had to say. I'm very proud and happy to welcome John into Fantastic Sandbox, the Pacific Rim universe. Mm-hmm. We'll be reinforced with him as a leading man as it continues to be a multicultural, multi-layered world. The world saving the world was our goal, and I continue to think of I can't think of a better man to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
This does make sense. He's coming off of Star Wars, and
yeah, he's a big deal.
And so, yeah, it makes sense, and I think that he is somebody that could. I think he's charismatic enough that he could step in for Idris Elba.
Mm-hmm. I think that was one of my biggest issues with Pacific Rim in general, is I wasn't really that into any of the characters. I liked a lot of the side characters, like Charlie Day and
yeah, that was my favorite
Ron
stuff.
Perlman and like those kind of people. But like the main characters, even Idris Elba, who I normally think is very charismatic, in that I felt like he was just kind of a dude, like a really, you know, military general kind of stoic type. I would like to see as somebody, even I know you weren't as into the character, but somebody like a Finn from Star Wars, who's a little bit more bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and, you know, can kind of be a better cipher for the audience.
A little bit more like a little bit more energy to the role.
Yeah, just a little more idiosyncratic, a little bit more something.
But there is a specific look, and I think that this could be interesting because I think that the franchise has places to go, and I don't think we saw enough to be... I think that it has a little bit of legs to go on.
I see no reason why you couldn't do more within this world, certainly. And in fact, I'm surprised, like, if this was 1999,
mm-hmm.
there would have been a Fox Kids cartoon version of the movie already that lasted, like, two seasons.
Right.
Like, remember when there was the Roland Emmerich Godzilla TV show?
Yeah, I do.
The cartoon. Or the Men in Black cartoon, which is actually kind of underrated.
The Beetlejuice cartoon.
Yeah, that goes back a little further, but yes.
Oh, I just had to get mine in, because that's the one I watched.
The Flash, the WB Flash movie, you know, part of the whole new DC universe, they lost their director a little while ago. And they just found a new director in Rick Famuyiwa, the director of Dope, which we both liked a lot last year.
Heck yeah, it was a great film.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's kind of funny is when I think it was the episode I did with Brad and Amanda when we talked about Keanu, when we covered the story about them losing their other director, which now I forgot who that was. It probably says in the story I'm supposed to be looking at. But I said that if they're going to... Oh, yeah, Seth Graham Smith was originally going to direct it, and left because of, quote-unquote, creative differences. And I said if they're going to get somebody, they're going to get somebody cheap. They're going to get somebody unknown because Seth Graham Smith is an unknown, basically, and they're going to want somebody who's going to play ball if he left because of creative differences.
Mm-hmm.
That's not exactly how this went. In fact, they found somebody who's... I don't know if I'd go so far as to call an auteur, but kind of. Like, he's made a few movies in his day. He has kind of a specific style and a point of view. His movies kind of say something about race relations or whatever. So, it's interesting that they bring in a guy like this. I don't know what he's going to do with The Flash, with Ezra Miller starring in it. Probably nothing. I'm sure he is just there to take on the job. But it's interesting that they didn't go with my prediction, which was that they would find someone cheap and young.
Well, it is kind of... these films really do need to be able to please a large audience.
Yeah.
And there is an audience right now that... wants, you know, directors and filmmakers and writers and that aren't cisgender white males.
Sure.
And so I think there's a political one, but I don't think that's bad, because in the term of Dope was a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it can break some of that energy and some of that kind of characterization to that film.
Yeah. Because Flash should be fun.
Yeah. And
than maybe any other DC universe character. I mean, they all need to be like a lot more fun than they've been so far.
Sure.
But that one in particular, you can't do grim, or it's just going to get so campy.
He should be the most fun, sure. And especially, I mean, it depends on which route they go. I'm a weirdo, and I do want them to go the whole, like, Gorilla Grodd, like, weirdo route. But
sure.
For me, I think that's a good direction. And if he is able to, like, imbue them with, like, personality, like the movie Dope had with its different, several different characters, then I think it could be a really good fit.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to save their giant universe crossing multi-film franchise, that's a good route to do that. Is to make a movie with personality that's actually good. So
originally the screenplay was drafted by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, and then rewritten by Seth Graham Smith, who was going to direct it. So I'm sure it's going to go through yet another rewrite with this new director.
True.
If not him, then a team of people he trusts.
Well, and I think, and if I understand correctly too, I guess Ben Affleck's kind of moving into a more executive producer role throughout the films.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he won't. Maybe I misinterpreted that, but
I've heard around that Zack Snyder is taking a backseat, kind of. Like, I think the studio's not terribly happy with him.
That's what that seems like from, like, the different articles and stuff, and some of the moves they've made. And,
yeah, the stuff you read. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't really know. I could only assume, since it didn't make over that billion mark they really wanted. So, yeah, no, it seems like a cool fit. If as long as it's they give him the space and the room to make the movie that it should be.
Yeah, agreed. What's your last story?
So this isn't set in stone, but it's close to. She's the early front runner for the role of Captain Marvel. That would be Brie Larson. She is my movie girlfriend. I'm very pleased that she's going to be in this role, but I think in more serious kind of talk, yeah, I think that she's a great choice for this, and she's fairly young,
mm-hmm.
which I think adds a good dynamic to the character,
mm-hmm.
because I think you have some older, kind of like with Robert Downey Jr., and you have some older cast already there. I think you need to start, if you're going to start kind of expanding and opening up these different characters, you have to start getting some younger blood in there in these type of roles. And I mean, truthfully, she's a great actress, so I don't see it being anything but good.
Uh-huh. Recent good stuff, Oscar winner, Brie Larson.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I kind of forget about that.
She won Best Actress for the movie Room.
Yeah, yeah, well, so, I've liked her for a long time, because I've liked her since she was on United States of Terror. So, like, I haven't seen The Room yet, even. So
you've been on the Brie train for a while.
Yeah, yeah. I've always found her adorable, and the little American sweetheart that she is.
I think the first thing I ever saw her in was that movie Rampart with Woody Harrelson. Orin Moverman wrote. It came out, like, I don't know, something like 4 or 5 years ago.
Hmm.
And she was like his, like, kind of precocious teenage daughter who couldn't deal with his bullshit anymore.
She played a lot of those in her career.
She's kind of made a career of that character, actually.
Yeah.
And then probably after that, Scott Pilgrim, which she was totally almost unrecognizable in.
Yeah. No. Well, yeah. And that she was a lot of fun as that character, too.
Yeah.
Envy. So.
Mm-hmm. So I'm into it. I think she's great, and I loved her in Room. I know this will be nothing like that, of course, but I think she
weird if it was.
It's exact same story, just with superpowers. I think I'm obviously she has more cachet now because she's an Oscar winner,
right?
Even if it was for a movie that most people didn't see. So now, you know, she can kind of pull in that sort of Jennifer Lawrence-esque pull.
Right.
In, well, she's, in the
she's
industry.
Also, I think one thing Marvel is very good at is casting. And so I think that this is, she isn't actually one of the people that I thought. I thought when I was watching The Huntsman, I thought that was an extended audition for the part of Miss Marvel, because you had two front runners with Jessica Chastain and Emily Blunt in there, and even Charlize Theron to some degree. And so I kind of thought that that's what route they were kind of going. And so when they said, when she came up as the lead for the part, I was like, actually, that makes a lot of sense, but in like a really a better way than I was thinking about the character. So again, I think her age and just her personality could make this a lot of fun.
I agree. And I'm excited about it. I guess we were talking a little bit of like, look, are we going to see her in an Avengers movie first? So lately that's sort of been their game, is test characters out in ensembles and then give them their own movie. Almost the opposite of what they were started out doing.
She could show up in, I mean, we know that Thor Ragnarok, the third Thor movie, is going to be a little bit more space epic.
Mm-hmm.
In nature, and it's going to have Hulk in it and stuff. So she could show up there, maybe. She could show up in Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Mm.
She that character does have ties to Guardians of the Galaxy.
There you go.
There's that. Or she could just show up in Avengers Infinity War or Gauntlet or whatever they're going with right now.
Yeah.
Part 1. And then she has a movie in between that one and the next one. So... And honestly, what I'm kind of like interested in right now with Marvel is the fact that a lot of their single movies, not as many of them, there are quite a few new heroes that are coming up on their docket. So, I mean, to see somebody like her fill in as like Captain Marvel or Doctor Strange coming into the mix or all these mm-hmm. different characters, I think is actually really kind of like more interesting, because we still got this cast of other characters in other films, and we're still building on it. And I was like, wow, this hasn't collapsed in on itself. This is actually really kind of interesting in a weird way.
Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm. All right, let's get into the movies. We're going to start here with our main review, which is Pop Star Never Stop, Never Stopping. And I joked before we decided exactly what we were going to review this week that we might as well review this because friend of the show, Keith Foster, is kind of in it.
Did you see him? I didn't.
No, I didn't. Did you look for him even?
I mean, I did because you said, but there were so many crowd scenes that I was like, okay.
Yeah, we should mention he didn't have.
Was
a
he?
Line.
Was he part? Was he in the window scene? Was that what it was?
What would you do? I know. Sadly enough, I know that it couldn't be.
Right. Well, there's already rumors who the window scene is, or they've said it is him several times, but
okay. Well, now we're just being super cryptic, but
yeah.
Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping is directed by Akiva Schaffer and Yorma Taccone, also star in the movie with Andy Samberg as the Lonely Island, not in the movie as the Lonely Island, but as the collective known as the Lonely Island, which sort of skyrocketed to fame with their involvement with the digital shorts on SNL in the mid-aughts. And in a lot of ways, really kind of defined what SNL's popularity through the 2000s was going to mean, kind of moving out of traditional sketch comedy into more internet viral stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Really become successful in their own way as like music producers, kind of, sort of. I mean, they are still sort of a joke band. They do a lot of kind of like hip-hop parodies and that stuff, but their albums do pretty well.
Right.
And they've even performed occasionally doing live sets and that kind of stuff. And I think they have a decent amount of respect within the music industry, even though their stuff is, you know, poking fun at most of these genres.
And a lot of these people.
And a lot of these people. So Popstar is the credit at the beginning of the movie is a Lonely Island film. And it is very much that. If you've seen their the digital shorts, if you've seen the type of stuff they parody, the type of angle at the hip-hop pop world that they have, that is very much continued with this movie. It's also sort of a little bit of a take on Justin Bieber and the Never Say Never documentary, which I've actually seen, BT Dubs, more than once. But I did not see the sequel to
Brave
it.
Brave of you to admit. Brave of you to admit.
It was a video store days. I watched a lot of things. So Andy Samberg kind of stars in this thing as a guy named Connor, who was the leader of a hip hop boy band, sort of Color Me Bad type, Beastie Boys ish type thing called the Style Boys, with him and his best friend Owen and another guy they know named Lawrence. And eventually, Connor sort of emerged as the star of the group in sort of a Justin Timberlake sort of way. And Connor became his, or Owen became his DJ, and Lawrence sort of left because of creative differences and ego and whatever. And so this movie sort of takes place at the time that Connor's blown up. Everything he does is huge. He's a Vine celebrity. Everyone's talking about him. He has a huge fan base. He just won all of the major pop awards and the VMAs and all that kind of stuff. And it's done in a sort of a mockumentary fashion, very, very much influenced, I think, by
Spinal Tap.
Yeah. And so you get a lot of talking head stuff with actual celebrities like, Questlove and, Nas and these kind of people who kind of comment on these fake celebrities in the movie and talk about how genius they were in that moment when they changed everything with the donkey dance or whatever it's called.
The donkey roll.
Thank you. And then so the point of time that this fake documentary is taking place is from the point which Connor's about to release his second solo album. And he's taking a lot of creative differences in his approach. Now he's bringing on more producers, and he's expanding and diversifying his brand and to include, like, being Wi-Fi'd into everybody's appliances. And when the album flops and everyone hates it and everyone hates having to hear his songs whenever they open their refrigerator, he kind of goes into an existential crisis and tries to get his notoriety back on a big tour with a kind of crazy, unpredictable Tyler, the Creator-esque rap artist named Hunter.
I just remember Sexual Tyrannosaurus. Right. That's from the song.
Hunter the Hungry, I think, is the Tyler, the Creator facsimile. What did you think of Popstar? Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Well, I was going to say that this was a realistic drama if you had me set it up, because this is exactly how I see the pop industry in general.
It's not far off.
It's not. For me, it is very much just what it is. Mm-hmm. What the pop industry is. But that being said, I think that they do really actually love pop music, and they know and do respect a lot of these people, and they understand what the thing is.
Yeah.
But that puts them in a good place to kind of poke fun at it in a real way. But going back to kind of what when you were setting up with the Lonely Island and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. this could have been, I think, a very disastrous thing.
It could have been too much. I know what you're about to say, but go ahead and say it.
Yeah, I think that this could have been set up to be just a failure and not really a narrative, and it just kind of a meandering thing of music, in which it kind of is, but. It was smart to make it one of like these pop star documentaries that are out there. Mm-hmm. They were smart also to just have this really kind of actually sweet narrative as well about friendship while it's simple, I feel like it's very true and it feels good. I actually really enjoyed this film. I thought it was pretty fun for the most part. Mm-hmm. I laughed quite a bit. While I could definitely see it, you know, that it paid homage to like things like Spinal Tap and a lot of these other things. I think it fit in really well and was it stood on its own feet. The parts where it did become like very Lonely Island and they did the music videos and stuff like that, it actually worked in very well just because of the subject matter.
The framing device of the documentary and because a lot right. of, I mean, if you watch those, a lot of those pop star, like fan docs, basically, the Bieber ones, I also saw the Katy Perry one.
Yeah, tell me about those. I have not seen them.
Well, I mean, I'll kind of use that as a jumping off point for my review.
True.
I agree. This was a very risky move for the Lonely Island and for Andy Samberg's, stardom and all of that stuff. Largely because if you see those documentaries, especially Never Say Never and some of those other ones, they do a pretty good job of parodying themselves. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do a whole lot to them sure. to make them as ridiculous as they truly are. And in some regards, I actually think that this documentary or mockumentary, whatever, this movie that the Lonely Island did, kind of actually was pretty kind to those movies and they could have gutted them a lot more than they did. But I think that they find a healthy balance of that structure that those movies have and bringing in a little bit of a narrative, and being able to basically have a simple enough kind of skeletal rise and fall story that we've seen 100 times over in these kinds of stories, these success industry stories.
It did, and often that can wear on me, but in this case, it really didn't. I don't know, maybe it's just the subject matter or whatever it covered, but for me, the fact that it was just a rise and fall.
Right.
Well, going back to your roots kind of story, I was like,
right.
You know what? I just found it kind of nice. I don't know.
Well, for the story they were telling, it'd be hard to tell any other story based upon how they wrote these characters. I will say that I think the plot is the least interesting part of it.
Sure.
There was a point in the movie once I realized kind of where it was going. I was like, oh, so it's going to be about hubris and flying too close to the sun and blah, 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 blah. But, and I kind of thought to myself, oh, okay, I know this. I've seen this before. But it kept surprising me in its jokes. And I'll be the first to admit that I like the Lonely Island music video stuff as digital shorts, as like these very compact, insular pieces of pop entertainment.
Sure.
I've never been a huge fan of Andy Samberg as a comedian, and I've never been a huge fan of him as an actor. So I went in with kind of mixed feelings. I didn't know what I was.
A little bit of trepidation.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was going to get, because there's a part of me that's always thought that Andy Samberg makes fun of these kind of dopey, bro-ish guys, but in real life, he probably just is one of those guys.
Mm-hmm. And he might be. I mean, making fun of yourself isn't a bad thing.
No, not necessarily. But a lot of times when I see him in like SNL doing sketch comedy, or when I see him some of the other Lonely Island stuff that wasn't as music related, I always kind of thought that he lacked a sort of a sense of self-realization to be able to poke fun of himself. Anyway, so I didn't know if I was going to dig him in this, and I was really surprised that I did. And I thought that he was actually really funny, kind of playing this sort of over-the-top Justin Bieber type. And I thought that there was a lot of surprising jokes in this. Like, every time I thought that I was in a territory where I was super familiar and I kind of knew where it was going to go, it would at least throw in a very funny concept. Mm-hmm. And it's a type of movie that doesn't necessarily have to be realistic all the time. And so, actually, I think that the strengths of this movie is when it gets super bizarre, that's kind of Harold and Kumar style of humor, or I guess you could go all the way back to like Airplane or something like that. But when it takes a concept that you are familiar with, or a genre trope, and then it just plays it to an extreme, and then keeps going past the point of absurdity. Mm-hmm. That's the stuff I love in this movie, is when they would take a joke so far that I didn't see them taking it that far.
Agreed. So what we put all these like cautionaries, like it could have failed because of this. I think it did because of any of those things, because what they did was just make a very successful comedy, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I've seen a comedy that's made me laugh constantly as much as this did. I mean, I'll be the first to admit that I prefer comedies that are a little bit more cerebral and a little bit smarter.
Yeah.
As opposed to your kind of like bro-y, but it's not. It's very popcorn-y and kind of poppy, or whatever you want to call it. But I found it to be very humorous, and kind of almost like it. To me, this is almost like a throwback to a lot of those like really fun like 80s kind of comedies that you can go back to several times just because they're kind of funny. And I think that this might be one of those. I really enjoyed it. And again, I think that just having that sweet, simple, like kind of friendship at the center of it, I think it made it work, help it along as well. I also just some of the concepts they came up with, and a lot of it, like you said, a lot of the gags, it worked.
And usually in movies like this, gags can like gag me. Like, honestly, like,
you, sure.
when it's something that's just so absurd or ridiculous, and they're like, well, we just have to put it in the movie anyway, because we just need to keep people laughing. Usually I hate that. I agree with you. When it comes to comedies, I like the jokes to support story. But in this, the story is the least interesting thing, so it's actually the gags sort of support themselves. I do consider it sort of in that camp of like the Airplane. mode of movies.
Well, I was reading, I read a few articles with some of, and watched some interviews and stuff like that. And Airplane was one of the movies that they literally
mentioned
that they were kind of looking at when they were making this film. Mm-hmm. So you bringing that up is probably spot on. So.
All right. Yeah. I mean, it is kind of one of those things. And I do agree that, like, I wouldn't go so far as to call this an instant classic, but in that sort of Airplane sort of way, or that Naked Gun sort of way, or whatever, I could see this being like a movie that people quote often because it is kind of episodic and it's more about its parts than the whole.
Sure. It does have quotability for sure.
Yeah. You know, the stuff about the wolves and
the wolves was good. I really liked, there was the window scene that we were referring to earlier.
Right.
That's a great setup, but I don't want to ruin that for anybody.
Right. I agree with that. It. Yeah.
The other one is, I really liked the, when they were making fun of Daft Punk and the big, helmet.
Yeah.
I just, that got me every time almost.
That was a funny concept.
Yeah.
I mean, it is very sketch comedy-esque. So a lot of it is about the scenes and the setups more than, I pretty much recommend this movie. I think we're both kind of surprised by this.
I'm always reserved when it comes to comedies. Mm-hmm. I just do not connect to them, or I find them kind of dumb or tedious. And this film, no, I it's not necessarily like, I'm not saying it's a smart comedy. It's done in the right way, and it's really, I mean, this isn't like a Wes Anderson kind of comedy, but this is a gaggy kind of fun throwback to like I said, those very rewatchable 80s kind of, you know, I even like something like absurd, like, you know, like Anchorman or something like that. I think also it kind of stands in that realm. And I do think that this is going to be, even if it doesn't do super well right now, I think it's going to pick up an audience.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, if Hot Rod can have a cult audience, then surely this movie can.
And it should. I mean, I think it's edited well, too. I think it flows really well. Mm-hmm. I think that the aesthetics look very well. I think it was shot pretty well. I think it's a pretty well done little thing, put together a machine, and I really can't fault it too much.
Uh-huh.
I think it is what it is. So if you don't like gaggy sort of silly comedies, then maybe you won't like this. But I found it pretty funny. So
yeah,
I recommend it as well.
I definitely do. The only criticisms I would have of it, I've already kind of criticized that the plot is just kind of whatever. And I don't necessarily buy the friends forever aspect of it, even though they literally have been friends forever. Mm-hmm. So I guess if you look at the extra textual stuff, that could have more heart than I think that necessarily in the movie. But my only other criticism is about the music itself. Mm-hmm. It's fine. All of the songs are funny, and the little comedy set pieces that are built around these music videos and stuff, they all play just like a Lonely Island track, and they're funny like a Lonely Island track. But as a story, you're supposed to believe that the stuff Connor was writing at one point was significantly better than the stuff he's writing now, at the point at which the movie takes place, his second album.
Sure.
I didn't notice much of a difference, and also, they play like Lonely Island songs, so they're funny in concept. It's, you know, I sort of had the same problem with Get Him to the Greek a long time ago, because that was a very similar movie as far as its story.
Sure.
And that kind of had a similar issue where it was like, oh, his second album flopped and now everyone hates these songs and isn't this ridiculous? But it's like, it's all kind of in that same realm as being a parody song.
But at the same time,
like that's not super important for the movie because you just have to believe in the world of this movie. This album did bad and that one did good. That's all you really need to go forward in the story. But I think maybe a slightly sharper take on that would have been able to differentiate what all that stuff's supposed to mean in the greater scheme.
Okay. I mean, I think that's very very getting into the minutiae of it, but that's perfectly fine. I don't really have a whole lot. I think that if you like Lonely Island, you like silly comedies, or sometimes even like I don't really. I did like this, and I do recommend it. And I think that I don't think that the Friends Forever thing is throwaway. I think it's very much a part of it, and very much it's kind of friendly and just like warm. I don't think that every movie has to have this. I love subtext when it's there, but there are certain types of films that don't need it. And I don't know. I don't think that this one really needed too much more to it.
Like I said, the story is so simple. It's just a skeleton to hang jokes on.
It would be too bloated. And I think that
we don't need also, to know a I lot think, more about these characters.
Also, I think that you did want the Lonely Island, kind of the music. And it does sound very similar throughout, but I mean, that could almost, you could also take that as a blow to pop music, because to me, when you're talking about their former stuff to their new stuff, to the solo album stuff, and they're saying, well, this just wasn't as good. A lot of times I'm like, it sounds exactly the same to me. So
yeah, it usually has a lot more to do with the audience aging out of it than it necessarily has to do with the quality of that artist.
Exactly. And yeah. So to me, it was like, it seems pretty much like, yeah, that's what it is.
Right.
But I don't know. I enjoyed it. And I think that they put in the right cues and the right speeds and the right everything. And the timing was really on. And I think it works for what it's supposed
to be. It's paced very, very well. Yeah. It's not too long. It's an hour and a half. It doesn't overstay its welcome like an Apatow movie. So it actually, yeah, I recommend this wholeheartedly. I think it's funny. I walked in with my arms folded going, okay, guys, impress me. And I was laughing 5 minutes in.
Yeah, I was laughing pretty much from the start. Mm-hmm. So I didn't go in with that much reservation. I was like, we'll see what this is. But should we move on to our Netflix homework?
Yeah, we'll finally get to it.
Well, there's not. This is a very like bare bones kind of movie. It was done by David Gordon Green. It stars Paul Rudd and Mel Hirsch. It's basically about two guys doing road work and kind of their relationship, and they're connected through Rudd's fiance, who is Mel Hirsch's sister. And it's kind of about, you know, two guys in very different parts of their lives with two very different ways of looking at life, and them trying to kind of coming of age. And
right.
I really, this film, I kind of enjoyed it at first, and I was like, okay, this is going to be kind of a fun, like, road movie in slow motion.
Sure.
It's basically about these two guys doing like this construction and this work on in this area that in Texas that had this huge forest fire and ruined and wrecked havoc and blah, blah, blah. As the film goes on and progresses, I think it still remains funny, but it seems to really lack, I don't know, just a through line.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always need a through line, but in this particular case, I don't think that the movie really went anywhere in the themes and what was happening, you know, even if they were very personal themes. I don't think it really paid off in the end in any sort of relevant way. And so I kind of feel like this film, I have to talk about the broad arc because I don't really, some of the minutiae, because it's been a couple of weeks, I don't remember some of it. But what I do remember is I wasn't very satisfied by the ending. It just kind of ended.
Just kind of teetered off. Yeah, I agree with you. I think what you're getting at, it's not even necessarily lacks a through line. It kind of lacks a narrative thrust. Mm-hmm. Like you never, I kind of kept waiting for the movie to start.
And
I kind of watched it in chunks, you know, like, through the week, like when I could, like fit it in between starting and stopping working. But I watched the bulk of it, like an hour of it, like night before last or something like that. And by that point I was like, it still feels like the first 15 minutes of a movie. Like, I still don't really, I mean, I know kind of what these characters are about in the very broadest sense. Like, Emil Hirsch is young and he wants to get laid and he talks a lot of shit about getting laid. And Paul Rudd's kind of world weary and was ready to settle down and whatever. And I think Paul Rudd gives it a really good performance in this movie. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have a whole lot to do really or to say, but I think within that he was able to really kind of build something. And And it's kind of interesting looking at this movie in context of Paul Rudd's career and David Gordon Green's, because they both kind of had a similar trajectory, and that David Gordon Green started out as this very serious director, this mm-hmm. indie director. He did this movie called George Washington, which has nothing to do with the president, which was his first film, and it was released on the Criterion Collection. And then he did the Snow Angels with Kate Beckinsale, and he did All the Real Girls, and all of these like really kind of low budget things that are kind of similar to Prince Avalanche in some ways and not in other ways. But he, at the time, he was kind of being like around the time of George Washington, especially, he was kind of being touted as the next Terrence Malick. And then he went and made Your Highness and Pineapple Express and The Sitter. These extremely broad, goofy comedies that are all about gags. I mean, like we were talking about, like with Popstar, I would say that those movies in particular are the type of those kinds of movies I don't like, where the jokes are not supported at all and they're really dopey. And
which movie did you say?
Any of his comedies, like any of his Apatow.
I'll agree with you, except for Pineapple Express. I enjoyed that one. It was a fun buddy pot movie.
I haven't seen Pineapple Express in a long time, and I only saw it the once. But to me, that was when I felt that formula of those actors and that Judd Apatow mm-hmm. thing starting to bend under its own weight. To me, that was a beginning of a that was when that whole thing peaked. And by that point, I was a little less charmed. And I think largely just because I don't think David Gordon Green's really good at that material. But this movie was sort of after doing those three movies in a row, and everyone's like, what the fuck happened to David Gordon Green?
sure.
Like, holy cow, did he sell out? But this movie is kind of a return to what he used to do, but you still see a little bit of a toe in that world that he used,
right.
The comedy world that he just came from. And same with Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd was, you know, after Clueless and doing commercials or whatever he did before that, he was this indie guy for a long time. I mean, he had like kind of a big role in Friends and that kind of stuff, but he did all of these little indie movies and these kind of serious films and was kind of seen as this, you know, Sundance actor. And then he did like Wet Hot American Summer and kind of got caught up in the comedy world. And was, you know, pretty good at it. And now he's the Paul Rudd that we all know, is who can be really funny, and he can do movies like Ant-Man, and he can do movies like Anchorman and whatever.
Sure.
So in a way, this sort of reunites him and David Gordon Green with their indie pasts. Like, these are both the types of movies they would have done in, like, around 1999.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. The movie itself is not. Which is a long-winded way of kind of saying that. But, you know, the extratextual stuff is kind of interesting if you're following these people's careers. The movie itself is, like I said, I kept waiting for it to start. To me, it's a little too ponderous. It's a little too Terrence Malick light in, like, oh, the camera, we'll shoot these cows kind of walking in the herds in the background, and now we'll look up at the trees and... You know, and it's poetically it's going to mean something, but it never really does. There's this kind of weird thematic thing, which maybe I just didn't care enough to try and put it together with this old couple. Maybe they're real. Maybe they're not. Like, I don't know. I found a lot of it to be almost self-parody of like a Sundance movie with big actors that nobody's seen or will remember.
Yeah, I can more, maybe I enjoyed this a little bit more, because I don't know if I necessarily would go that far, because there are several of the movies that you're talking about that I would completely feel that way, and have felt that way, or I just don't remember that I watched them.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I don't know, maybe it was the performances. I also kind of enjoyed watching them beat the shit out of each other in the woods for a while.
Yeah, that's the stuff really, that's almost kind of... Like, there's these moments in it of levity where it's almost like you feel that little bit of like, oh, these guys are kind of bringing in their comedy stuff.
Right.
And it's not even necessarily appropriate, but at least it's more entertaining.
Well, I enjoyed that, but I also enjoy it. Like, there were all these, like, little moments that I really did enjoy in the film. And so maybe that's just, you know, there are times that I watch a movie and certain directors, and I say, man, you can really direct a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You can really get a lot out of this moment, but you can't necessarily pull it all together as a complete narrative. Or even if you're not looking for, like, a very traditional narrative, you have to have that thematic pull throughout the center.
Right.
This, I actually think, could have gone there. I just didn't buy it with the ending. The ending just kind of stopped, and you're like, oh, okay, this happened. If it went somewhere, then if it finished at a certain note, mm-hmm. then I actually could have liked this movie a little bit more, but I don't, it didn't. I think that right. there are some, I think it is hinting at some, like, different stages of adulthood and relationships mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I think it is, but it doesn't come together. I can't say that I necessarily hated the film, but
no, I didn't hate the movie either. And I see everything that you're saying, and I agree with you. I felt like this movie was like a draft or two away from being what it should have been. Like, I felt like he took a screenplay, and who knows how long you actually worked on it? Maybe very long. Maybe he labored over it. I don't know. But to me, it felt like...
It just
like,
didn't come together.
To me, it felt too much like a bunch of ideas rather than a complete project. Because I felt like there's... It hints at a lot of things it could be. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, they mentioned this, like, going to, like, a beauty pageant at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie kind of ends before that point. Spoiler alert, I don't know. But... and I was like, that would be an interesting movie. I don't want to see them, you know, having conversations while they're doing road work. Like, that could have been the first 15 minutes, because, like I said, this whole movie feels like a first act.
It does.
Extended. And then, like, to see, like, the dynamic that we've established in this movie, to see what that would have been in a setting like a beauty pageant, where now they're in these very extreme, vulnerable places as characters, that's the movie.
Well, also as in different maturity levels.
Yeah.
I think, like, it'd be interesting from
also
being,
is,
you know, a 18-year-old boy compared to a 30-year-old man. There is a steep incline there. And you know, I would.
And that stuff's interesting. Yeah.
And
I agree with you. There's moments in this movie, some dialogue set pieces and stuff, where I think they're both very good. Although sometimes the dialogue is weirdly simple and underwritten, where it almost feels like stage play. But yeah, there's moments between the two actors and some chemistry that they have that works. But I think in spite of the movie.
That might be, and it might be coming from, like, partially the actor. I mean, it could be a lot of different. I can't really tell. I just feel like I'm watching an unfinished movie.
Yeah.
It really is what I really feel about the film. Again, there is some stuff with friendship and growing older and stuff like that that is of interest to me, and I was interested while I was watching it, but it didn't come together in any meaningful way, and it didn't really, and I don't necessarily need, again, I'm using these, like, kind of like writing terms for a very basic kind of narrative,
yeah,
but at the same time, I just didn't really feel like it came to a proper resolution.
No, I agree, and it doesn't need necessarily, like, a, you know, a really convenient third act where everything is explained and everything's, like, left, like, you know, a Nora Ephron comedy or something.
Sure.
You know, or some postscript at the end, and this is what happened to the, you know, I just would have, I said it already, I'll say it again. To me, this whole movie's a first act.
And I think that's a pretty good way to sum it up. I didn't grate on me as much from what it sounds like in your review, because I really actually, this kind of flowed pretty easy for me. I watched it and it happened, and then I was like, wait, what? It's done?
Yeah, it had me in fits and starts. Sometimes I was like, okay, I can kind of get into the rhythm of the mood of the movie, and then it would kind of go into a sloggy part where I was like, okay, movie, get going. You're 45 minutes in and you still haven't done anything.
Do you think it's because of how you viewed it?
I mean, I'm sure that may be sort of influenced in some way, but like I said, I watched the bulk of it in the last bit. Yeah, I think it was only that first half hour that I had seen kind of separated, but, it's whatever. It's fine. Like, if you want to see these actors and you want to see David Gordon Green, if you're a fan of his, I know that his next movie that he did after this, Joe, now he's on something of a comeback because he did this, he did Joe, and which stars Nicolas Cage, but somehow has still got pretty good reviews. They did that movie with Sandra Bullock.
Our Brand is Crisis.
Yeah. Which came to mixed reviews, but I mean, coming from the guy who had just done Your Highness a few years later, that's saying something.
Yeah.
So there's glimmers of talent in all of it, but it didn't come together for me.
No, I don't think that there's a lot to really say about it because it is very sparse and without that thematic ending and that way to pull it all together, you can't really say much about it except for there was all these disparate parts kind of strung together. So
it's
I think we both in the bulk, we agree.
Right. It's a performance film. You watch it for the acting if you're really interested in it.
If you're really into, I would say really if you're into Paul Rudd, because I think that that's the biggest performance. That's the best.
Right.
Emil Hirsch is okay.
He's fine. Yeah, I agree. Okay. Next week on something completely different. We are going to review a little horror film that came out earlier this year called Hush. And it went to Netflix pretty quickly because this is still a 2016 movie. But yeah, indie horror, I guess slasher. I don't know that much about this movie other than it. You know, people wrote about it a little bit when it first came out.
If a movie gets a little bit of buzz, if they can pick it up for cheap, really at the get-go, and it's like it first release to the public, I've noticed Netflix will do that. So it'll be exciting to see.
And we like horror movies, and it'll be fun to talk about.
Yeah, and now that slasher movies aren't in vogue, it's kind of weird to go and watch one of those.
So. Sure. Okay. Well, if anybody has anything to say about Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping, or Prince Avalanche, or Hush, or anything we might have brought up in this episode. Oh, man.
What's your punishment?
Damn it.
You're not out of it.
I forgot a couple things.
Oh.
Okay. I forgot that Patrick sent us a letter, too.
He did.
That's right. So I'll go ahead and get onto that. First, Winston Conrad said... He said that given Cassidy's antipathy for gross food and dampness, I suggest the punishment should be a double feature of Parents and Splash. There you go.
on Netflix, you have to watch them. You can't get onto YouTube during any point in time.
I've seen Splash.
This is from Patrick. He's one of our good friends from...
Pod Friends.
Yeah, he's a pod friend. He writes, "Hey guys, really great past few shows. I think you summed up the darkness well by explaining how it felt to elicit any emotion, either horror or laughter, as it being a farce. There seems to be a glut of low-budget, high-profit horror-ish films produced in the past decade, plus. And if you had some big data guru crunch the numbers, you'll probably find that most are middling. Middling horror films are the lowest forms of art in my mind, because at low end of schlocky or poorly done horror, you can crack a few beers, turn off your mind, and enjoy some camp. 10 years down the road, it will be on some top 10 list, online listicle, unfortunately, so bad it's good for blank, fill in the blank reason. On the other hand, is the competitive horror film, of course, that hits all the right marks and is perennial film watched years down the road.
Yeah.
I know as you're reading this, Richard, or this Cassidy, I'm sure you, Richard, are thinking, well, no shit, Patrick. Way to state the obvious in a blowhard fashion. Average is forgotten. But I just want to say we are undaunted as a film audiences with more average horror films because as a genre, they seem to be some damn profitable no matter the content.
And then
he goes on to insult you about not liking the Purge movies. And
right.
We'll get into that later. to respond a little bit, I wrote him back and I kind of talked to him a little bit about how, I think that's true for most movies, even if we're talking about great dramas or whatever serious kind of stuff you're talking about. If you're really into the end of the year, prestige films, all of that is really driven by taste a lot. Because if you have a certain like fetish for gore or whatever, you'll go to those things more often. And horror is certainly driven by that a lot. If it's gore or the thrill or you just like to watch something that's not like happy and mainstream or whatever. So, I mean, horror has that weird pull towards people. And I agree there are a lot of average films, but, you know, something like that we watched a little bit ago in Netflix, Homer Frankenstein's Army, which didn't appeal to you at all. And I would say narratively isn't very strong of a film. But if you're into like makeup effects and you're into kind of like schlock and stuff like that, I think that will really fulfill some people's needs. Like, and I very much got it at that level. And you don't see a lot of people go really serious in making a World War II Frankenstein kind of pulp stuff, especially at that budget. So I was like, no, that's pretty fucking great. So it really depends. I think it is driven by that. But when like we're talking. I mean, this kind of gets into, I guess, like reviewing and stuff. To me, it's not really about us, like whether we agree on it. It's just about the conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it should be anyway. Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes we go
sometimes
at each other,
not,
but it's just dumb.
Well, I mean, to piggyback on that a little bit. Yeah. I'd say I've always said the worst thing a movie can be is boring.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I, you know, Frankenstein's Army, I would not call a good movie, but I think that it is entertaining. I mean, what was that Canadian thing that I made us watch? Things, the movie.
Oh, that really, really bad.
Yeah, 1980 Canucksploitation.
Did we talk about that on?
I think we might have. I don't remember. Things. Look it up. It's on YouTube. But
yeah,
it's incredibly bad, but it's kind of funny, and at least like it's so bizarre and idiosyncratic and it's ineptitude that it's worth kind of at least seeing once.
Well, it's so off the beaten path and something you
right.
just don't
real
see every day.
Outsider art kind of yeah. stuff. So I agree with Patrick in that sense. A movie that just sits there, that's just so by the numbers, or you've seen it 100 times, or you know exactly where it's going to go, and it does nothing new, has no inspiration, has no style, no anything. It's just is what it is.
Well, if it was in defense, like, no, The Darkness, like, I like plenty of not prestige worthy or whatever you want to call films. I like plenty right. of B-movies. I'm a cult movie guy. I prefer that kind of film.
Same here.
I don't like prestige yeah. as much. But if we're talking The Darkness was a shitty movie. It was a bad movie. And so with that one, I felt bad giving it a bad review because I don't necessarily like doing that, but it just was bad. So in defense of calling, it wasn't average. It was bad.
It was below average. It was well yeah. below average. But it was aggressively plain. Also, and I'll bring this up, you know, Patrick writes us a little often, and we always enjoy reading his letters, but I'm really surprised at do you watch as many, did you go out and see everything we're going to talk about because we're going to talk about it, or did you really want to go see The Darkness? Because I really felt like I bit the bullet on that one.
Right
Like, did you go see The Darkness because you thought it might be good, or like, because I'm just right now as a podcaster to another podcaster, you don't have to do that.
I've said in comments and posts, we do the work that you don't have to. There are certain films, if you're not sure, you can listen to us and we'll try to be spoiler free. We watch them so you don't have to. I actually don't know if he did see that. I think he was more commenting about, I think it was a mixed, because we also got in the fight about The Purge.
That's true.
And you are wrong in that, and he was right to defend it.
We're not going to get into it, but I will say that if you're really interested, because he asked me if I'm like high or something like that, if you really want to know my take on The Purge, go back and listen to our previous Purge episodes. They're both on the site at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. You can look in the search bar under The Purge. You'll find both of our reviews, or you can go to solidworkreviews.blogspot.com. And you can search for both of my written reviews for The Purge and The Purge Anarchy and read my take on why I don't think those movies are nearly as smart as they think they are.
And again, you think that. I don't think that they think they're that smart. I think they're more interested in having fun. They just tend to be set in a world of semi-politics as well. And I think that that's okay. I think you're wrong. You're so wrong, Cassidy. I'm ready to fight you right now, right here. Let's not get into The Purge. I'm telling you, you cannot survive this.
You'll purge me on air.
I'm thinking about it.
All right. You can also find us on Stitcher and iTunes, the Zune, Pocket Cast, and Windows Podcast Network. You can read my reviews at SaladForkReviews.blogspot.com. You can also find me at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Brad Decker, friend of the show, he's been on the show a few times. He does a website all about sort of academic look at comics and film and literature and reviews and all sorts of stuff over at panelandframe.com. And be sure to listen to Patrick at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational, both great shows that we have been on before. Go check out Rod and Denise at The Listening Party. They just took a podcation, and I think they just came back and put out a show this week after a couple weeks off. And go ahead and listen to our friend Leland over currently in Olympia, Washington. Don't know where he's going to, if he's going to keep doing the podcast once he's in New Hampshire. But go check out his comedy podcast, dampercast.com. And that's the show. Bye.
Have a good one.